You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. We're thrilled to be able to present Saul Friedlander at the Los Angeles Public Library for the first time, at least since I've been here, so this is a really special day. If you're interested in hearing more about the work of the Los Angeles Public the Library Foundation in supporting the Los Angeles Public Library, which is such a critical institution in our democracy now, and we hope that you'll become a member and join this vibrant community and the great work that it's doing, please talk to me or one of my colleagues afterwards. We'd love to tell you more about it. Our format tonight is a conversation. We are recording for podcasts, so when we take your questions, we ask that you wait until a microphone comes around to you. And afterwards, Saul will be signing his books in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. And I hope you'll come to other Aloud events. We have some great programs coming up this spring, a program coming up with George Saunders at the Writers Guild Theater, and we have wonderful programs planned for summer. So please make sure you're on our mailing list and we can tell you what's coming up. Saul Friedlander writes, he was, quote, born in Prague at the worst possible moment, unquote. That moment was 4 months before Hitler came to power. Saul grew up in a German-speaking, non-practicing Jewish family in a world dominated both by his own innate wonder at the beauty of the world, the Prague of castles and cobbled streets, as well as his parents' fear of captivity. Before attempting to flee to the safety of Switzerland, his parents hid their only child in a Catholic school in France, where he survived the war. His parents did not. They were arrested at the Swiss border, sent back to the French police, and eventually murdered in Auschwitz. Friedlander has led a most distinguished career as an Israeli historian and professor of history at UCLA. His historical works have received great praise, including the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for his book, The Years of Extermination, Nazi Germany and the Jews, 1939 to 1945. His memoir of his childhood, When Memory Comes, now re-released with a new introduction by Claire Massoud, ranges from atmospheric walks with his governess in pre-war Prague, to his boyhood in that Catholic school in France, to his arrival in Israel at age 15, a few weeks after the creation of the state. It makes for mesmerizing and often startling reading. In the great story of the Golem of Prague, a Jewish folk legend about a robot creature made of clay by a rabbi who runs amok in a fit of violent madness, he read this phrase, quote, "When knowledge comes, memory comes too, little by little. Knowledge and memory are one and the same thing." And I think when you read Paul's two memoirs, you will agree with this phrase. Professor Friedlander's new memoir, which we celebrate tonight, is called Where Memory Leads, in which he brings his story into the present day, describing an intellectual coming of age on three continents, an adult life shuttling between Israel, Europe, and the United States, and how he found his passion in the intellectual search to understand and explore Holocaust history. He'll be discussing his work and his life with historian Stephen J. Ross. Steve is himself the son of survivors. His mother survived Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, his father, the Warsaw Ghetto, Dachau. Steve's new book, which is coming out next fall, Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews and Their Spies Foiled Nazi and Fascist Plots Against Hollywood and America, tells the story of 13 years of Jewish resistance to American Nazis and fascists. And as he writes in his prologue, quote, "It's a story almost too amazing to be true, but it is," unquote. Steve is a professor of history at USC. He's currently the director of the Kasdan Institute for the Study of American Jewish Life, and he's the prize-winning author of several books. So please join me in welcoming our two very distinguished guests to the stage of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Well, first, thank you all for coming here this evening. And I want to treat Saul's memoir, which is quite remarkable, as if it was a symphony in five movements. And we're going to start with his war and immediate post-war years, finding his place in Europe, Israel, and the United States in the 50s and early 60s, his academic career, studying the Shoah, sort of his life in Israeli politics and Israel from the 40s until he left for the United States full-time, and finally ending with observations and lessons for today. So let's start with your youth. You were born in Prague in October 1932. Your family fled to France, and in 1942 you were placed in a Catholic seminary. You then managed to smuggle yourself to Palestine in 1948 to join the Irgun. So here's my question. What did it mean to young Saul Friedlander to be a Jew, and to be a Jew of the diaspora? And given the fact that you've lived in France, New York, Israel, and Los Angeles, are you at home anywhere, or are you the wandering diasporic Jew?
I guess that the last point is the real one. No, I am not at home anywhere, but I'm also at home everywhere. You see, there is another side to your question. I mean, your question was directed at the wandering Jew, but it can also be a Jew who feels an emigrant everywhere, but also at home everywhere. And many Jews have felt that way. After all, don't forget. For those who are Jewish here, their families have often come through various stages, and I simply did the same. I mean, I'm a child of my time, which is the 30s and the 40s, and the early 50s. And it's not so astonishing that I went from place to place, and that in a way molded my multifaceted protein, as Lifton would say, personality. That is, but we are all, I mean, you are a woman and you are an American and you are this and you are that. Today we are all multiple personalities, so it's not so astonishing.
Well, you stayed in Israel from 1948 and returned to France in 1953 to attend Sciences Po. Why not remain in Israel? What drew you back to Paris, and what was it like to be a Jew in Paris in the early 50s?
Why not remain in Israel? I came as an enthusiastic Zionist. I didn't join the Irgun in Israel. I joined the Irgun in Paris, not knowing what the Irgun was about. They asked me, what do we want? And a friend of mine had told me what to answer. I said, both shores of the Jordan. And that was enough. I had no idea where the Jordan was exactly and what both shores meant. That certainly I didn't know. So I came to Israel as an enthusiastic Zionist. The Irgun then was didn't maintain itself. Ben-Gurion put an end to the Irgun as it was. And I lived in a small village near Netanya, in Nira, managed to get to high school in Netanya, passed the high school exams, went to the army, and so on. But, and that's your question, of course, I felt nostalgia for Europe. Why? How can nostalgia be explained? I don't know. But one day I saw a kind of documentary in the local cinema on a swimming pool in Paris, the Ligny, which is a famous swimming pool, and I felt, you know, such a nostalgia, which is strange because I had never seen that swimming pool, and I didn't know how to swim. So, I mean, this was really the most absurd kind of nostalgia, but it drove me back to Paris, and my explanation was that political science was better taught in Paris than at the Hebrew University, which at that time was true in the 50s. But again, it's more complicated. I became, within 2-3 weeks, an employee, local employee, at the Israeli embassy in France. I worked in the press department, my French being native, let's say, when we had arrived in 39, and then I went through years of French education, so it was native, and that's why the embassy took me in, and I worked for several years in the embassy, in the press department, then after the exams, in the military attaché's department on the eve of the Suez operation. So it was very interesting. But I left France then for Sweden.
I was very curious because you don't really talk about it in the memoir, but here you're living in Paris in France, and it's 1953 for a number of years. The war has ended. The Holocaust is over. To what extent were the French trying to come to grips with the aftermath of the war, with the Holocaust, and with their role in the Vichy regime?
Not at all.
That's
not at all, and the more there is a twist to it. Israel became very close to France at that time, and the French were sending a lot of military equipment, weapons of all kinds, airplanes, to Israel because they came close to, they had the sense that Nasser's Egypt was dangerous and was helping the Algerian freedom movement, that is the freedom, the movement for the liberation of Algeria, which became then the Algerian government, but years later. So at that stage, in 55, 56, there was an alliance between Israel and France, which the British joined at the last moment, and the Sinai War, that is Israel's attack on Egypt, helped by the French and then by the British, was all organized in Paris, if I may say, and I saw the people coming and going. So the French army was very much pro-Israel, but anti-Semitic. That is, the French army was right-wing, and maybe still is, I don't know. They certainly were pro-Israeli, but didn't like the Jews. So it's something so intricate in a way in the attitude of the French to the Jews. Now you ask me about the Shoah. The French were at that time absolutely uninterested. So were in a sense French Jews, the real French Jews, les Israélites français, that is the Ashkenazi French Jews. They had gone through the war, they managed, they didn't want to have anything to do with those who were the refugees. And as you know, that is who came from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, like our family, like my family, and who came from Eastern Europe mostly. The French were anti-Semitic, the population, and the French Jews wanted to make a difference between themselves and the foreign Jews who had arrived in the 30s and were mostly deported. I mean, if you look at the statistics, 90 and something percent of the foreign Jews perished in the Shoah, were deported, and very few French Jews perished. Now, there is one little coda to this, that is, in order to hide in France during the war, a foreign Jew, mainly an adult foreign Jew, could not hide. Why? Accent. You immediately recognized the Yiddish accent or German accent of the German accent of a foreign Jew. Only children like me, who became totally fluent in French and went through a basic schooling and so on and had no accent whatsoever, could hide under another name like me and under another religion. I mean, I had no religion before, but that was Catholicism during the war. And so the French were not at all interested in their collaboration with the Nazis at that time. And they became really aware, slowly, but became aware, when an American historian, Paxton from Columbia, wrote a book about Vichy. It took an American to really, Robert Paxton. And then there was another book, Robert Paxton, Michael Maris, Vichy and the Jews, and then the French started becoming aware of their past. But that was, Paxton's book was in the mid-70s, and Paxton and Maris was 82, I think. So it took some time. Mm. And then, now it's reversed, really. That is, Vichy is very much the Shoah, which is, I would say, the other extreme. That is, in histories of Vichy today, you have a huge chapter on the deportations, which the French police took care of it. Otherwise, the Germans wouldn't have been able to have the manpower for deportations. When I first read the history of Vichy in my studies in the 50s, there was not a line about the deportations.
So in August 1956, you resign your position at the Israeli embassy and you move to Sweden, where you spend the next 2 years working...
One year.
Yeah. Working in Salta at your uncle's clinic with mentally challenged children. And then that's right, because it's 1957, you leave Sweden for Harvard, where you found yourself, not surprisingly, bored. My friends in graduate school, my friends used to refer to Harvard History Department as a faculty-free zone.
Well, I don't know.
But you write that you were bored. So in January 1958, you moved to New York, and you get an interesting job as the political secretary to Nahum Goldman, who at that time was the head of the World Jewish Congress. And you worked for him for 2 years, from 58 to 60, spending half your time in New York, half your time in Jerusalem. So now I want the parallel question, in a sense, Paris, bring it to New York, that in New York City, what did you think of the Jews and the Jewish community that you met in yet another place? And again, I'm interested, to what extent did the Jews you met talk about the war and the Holocaust?
Not much. Not much. I was invited to Jewish families for dinners, for weekends, for dinners, because they had daughters whom they tried to marry. And, Secretary of Nahum Goldman, head of the, as you said, World Jewish Congress and the World Zionist Organization, I mean, mm-hmm. He was really the personality of the diaspora at that time, with a French accent on top of it, and an Israeli on top of it. Well, that was quite somebody to invite for dinner with the daughter. And the result was that I really laughed at the film, which many of you may not remember, Marjorie Morningstar. It was a book which became a famous film at the time, and I thought this was the real kind of ironic presentation of a jab of a Jewish American princess. But I had contact with Israelis, but not really, and that's strange. The Israelis remained among themselves. I had very little contact with American Jews. I worked within Goldman's outfit, but these were mostly Israelis or people interested in Jewish politics. I had little to do with it. I took care of correspondence and meetings with people who demanded to see Nahum Goldman and were not top. So I didn't meet many American Jews. Of course, I knew Rose Halperin and people like that. Some of you may know the names. Rose Halperin was the head of VITSO. And each time she was annoyed by something, she bought a new hat. So she had thousands of hats, apparently. But these were the kind of American Jews I met. They were officials. I didn't meet American Jews really at that time.
So you're moving back and forth between New York and Jerusalem, and then in 1960, you decide you're going to move back to Israel full time, and you get a pretty interesting job working at the Ministry of Defense with Shimon Peres in Tel Aviv. And at that time, they were working on the secret project to build Israel's first atomic reactor. And September 1961, you quit working for Peres and the nuclear reactor, and instead you decided to go to graduate school in Geneva to study wartime Germany. So my question, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, why would someone at the very center of power leave a promising potential career in Israeli politics at the highest of levels for an academic life? Why?
Well, if I hadn't done that, you would be speaking to a high official in the Ministry of Defense, retired probably. And you would ask about the nuclear reactor and so on. And I would say, I'm sorry, I cannot answer those questions. I mean, so you are lucky that I moved to another direction. I wanted to get back to what I didn't feel that I would, what I worked about was interesting, highly interesting. But it would have meant to go on, it would have meant becoming an official, a bureaucrat. Center of power or not, it was that. Going back to studies, which after all I had started and left and started and left, the Harvard example you gave, was more in my, that's what I felt was my, what I wanted to do in life. So I looked for a place which would give me a fellowship. That's why I arrived in Geneva, because I applied to the Hebrew University and they told me they had no assistantship or anything like that for me. So I applied to several places. And in Geneva, I got a small fellowship. And that's why I moved to Geneva. The language, of course, was a good thing. I knew French. And you could teach or study both in English and in French. International affairs, I mean, that was the main domain of that institute, part of the university. And I stayed there. I had my PhD there, and then I started. They gave me a job. It's not like today where all the graduates I know are looking for jobs and so difficult. At that time, 60s were the growth of universities all over Europe, in England, all the new universities in Europe. And I got a job within a few weeks.
A personal question, a history question now, that I was curious about. You finished your degree in October 1963, and your dissertation was on the foreign and military policies of Nazi Germany. It's 1963. It's less than 20 years from the end of the war. Didn't your advisors consider the topic too contemporary? Because I just have to tell you, I started as a graduate student at Oxford in 1971. And at Oxford, the history undergraduate degree, modern history at Oxford went from 400 AD to 1914. 1971. And I asked my advisor, who is the Rhodes Professor of American History, I said, why do you stop in 1914? And he said to me, totally straight-faced, he said, everything after that is journalism.
Well, it was, first of all, my topic was you got right the second half of the title. The real core of the topic was the American factor in German military and foreign policy, 39 to 41, that is beginning of the war in Europe to the entry of the United States into the war, that is Hitler declaring war on the United States in December 41. It means what did the German think about what would happen in the war if the Americans joined the British, of course. And it was studying German foreign policy mostly from that angle. Now, what you said is correct. And even today, I mean, even here in Los Angeles, history, really serious history, goes to 1914, or today it's maybe 1939, or not relating to World War II and Germany, because the archives of the German, of all German ministries, and particularly the foreign ministry of the Nazi period, had been caught by the Americans, the British, at the end of the war, brought to Fort Alexandria in Virginia. And then in the 60s, when I started researching, were given back to Germany, so that I had to travel to Bonn, which was the capital of Germany until the reunification, and there went to the foreign ministry of that time in West Germany, and was led to the archives which held the foreign, the documents of the foreign ministry of the Third Reich. Mm. So I asked for the U.S. files and so on, and whatever you could, as a historian, find in traveling to wherever for your modern history of the 15th century, you could find in the archives in Germany. You had everything, from the salary paid to a spy, to the highest political discussions about the next step. And just let me say, Hitler made everything to impede the entry of the United States into the war. He understood that this would be, for him, would be catastrophic, because of he knew about the industrial power, the potential addition of forces it would bring to the coalition, now Great Britain, Soviet Union, and now the United States. He understood that perfectly well and tried to convince the Japanese to attack the Russians in Siberia and not to go down to South Pacific, and just to get the Americans out of the war. It didn't work, so he declared war on the United States, not the other way around, because he knew that within days Roosevelt would manage to get into the European conflict as well.
You, after your dissertation, the work that really got you noticed and made the big splash was you went to the Vatican archives to investigate the relationship between the Vatican, Pope Pius XII, who had been elected in March 1939, and Nazi Germany during the war years. And you published a document that garnered international attention and created an international furor. And I think I got the title right this time. Pope Pius XII and the Third Reich, a documentary. And it was published in France in November 1964.
Right. And my then in the States and so.
Right. And my sense is this, you're right, that the response to your research, this is what I'm reading between the lines now, seemed far more favorable in Europe and in the United States than it did in Israel. And that you suggest in the late 1960s, studying the Shoah was not considered serious scholarship at Hebrew University. And if I read you correctly, you attribute it to the dominance of German Jewish professors at Hebrew University who couldn't come to grips with the fact that their beloved Germany could produce Hitler and Nazism. So when did that attitude change?
Should I say a few words about sure. the beginning of the question?
Sure.
I didn't go to the Vatican archives. I would have wished, of course, but to this day they are not open to research about the period of Pius XII and mainly the war period. I found a misplaced document in my American files, that is during my dissertation, a document asking the director of the German opera, Berlin Opera, which was supposed to come to Rome to give a series of concerts, brought to that director of the Berlin Opera from the Pope, Pius XII, whether the opera orchestra could come to his apartments and play parts of Parsifal, the last Wagner opera, which I couldn't believe my eyes. I mean, it was misplaced in the American, in the file on the United States. That's why I found it. I didn't go and have any idea about this topic until I saw, and I thought, in December 1941, that was the date of the demand, when it was before the U.S. entry into the war, but just at the end of the first part of the Russian campaign, hundreds of thousands had already been killed by the Germans, of civilians, Jews, Russians, and so on. So I saw the Pope asking a German orchestra to come and play in his apartment. That's really scandalous. And that's why I decided to get back after my dissertation to those archives and look at the Vatican files this time, which indeed were the Vatican archives, the German Vatican archives. And I did find documents which to this day I think cannot be contradicted easily. I mean, they cannot really. And which were not very pleasant for Pope Pius XII. And as you notice, I came back a little bit to my own past. I mean, I had spent the war in it. So I was accused to be ungrateful. I mean, after all, the church had saved my life, and here I was attacking the Pope. But many others were very much for the book, which appeared, which was published in France, indeed, in November, I think, 64. So it created quite a big scandal. But don't forget, there was also a theater play at the time. How do you call it? Le Vicaire, the representative or the...
The deputy.
Yeah, the deputy. The deputy, whose topic was actually Pius XII's rejection of saying anything about what the Germans were doing to the Jews. That is, saying a word about the extermination. Everybody, I guess, here, most of you would know that the Jews of Rome were deported on October 16, I think, 1943, when the Germans occupied the whole of Italy to the line held by the Allies who had landed in the south. And they were deported, as the diplomat said, under the Pope's very windows. And the German ambassador was very worried that the Pope, Pius XII, would get up in full regalia and say that this was unthinkable and barbarian, whatever, attacking the Germans. And Weizsäcker sent a telegram to Berlin saying, there is worry that the Pope will speak. And next day he sent a telegram saying the Pope will not say anything. Now, the question is why? And that was my big question, and that is the question since then. And as you know, to this day, there is a controversy on this, and we don't have the documents who are held at the Vatican.
And we probably never will see them.
Not sure. With this Pope, maybe. He may well open the archives. He may.
Let's move to Israel for a while now and go a little bit back in time. You're moving back and forth as you're working with Goldman between New York and Israel, and you write that by 1958, you first observed how poorly Israeli Arabs were treated, and at the same time, you also saw how poorly Mizrahi Jews were treated by their brethren and given the lowest, worst jobs in Israel. And in your book, you quote Moshe Dayan, who sees the conflict with Arabs as one that can never be solved. And he wrote, quote, "We have stolen their land to set up our state. Peasants never forget and never forgive those who live on their stolen land." What was your initial reaction to this double discrimination and to Dayan's statement?
My awareness started really with a visit that Goldman had to make into some Arab villages, Israeli Arabs which were under military control or whatever the word was. They were kept under military supervision, let's say. They were not free to go wherever they wanted, and so on. So we went to visit some villages, and at one of those villages, Goldman was invited, and I, of course, followed, to the mayor's office. And here I see, above the mayor's desk, two portraits. One on one side of the founder of Zionism, Theodor Herzl. On the other side, the founder of the state, David Ben-Gurion. So for an Arab to put those two portraits shows how humble, how humiliated they were, in my view. And of course, this was... The Dayan quote comes much later. I mean, this happened in, let's say, 59. Then in 66, we went back to a visit to Israel. In 67, we came back, came to teach. But in 66, we came to a visit, and a friend of mine who was very close to Dayan asked me, you know Moshe Dayan, who had been chief of staff and minister of defense, or not yet, but was a military personality and a personality of the really first rank after Ben-Gurion. I said, no, so we were, he phoned Dayan and we came to a visit. And I asked Dayan in the conversation what he thought about the conflict. He said, there is little chance of the conflict being ever solved. Why? He said, because the Palestinians, and he understood very clearly that the Palestinian issue was the central issue of the conflict. He didn't speak of the Arab countries. That was before the Six-Day War. That is before the annexation of the grip on the Palestinian territories beyond the borders. This was still the Palestinian problem as we saw it from within small Israel, let's call it that way. And I said, why? He said, because they're of peasant roots. And whether they are today, they are peasants or not, they are rooted in the soil. And as you read, I mean, they see their own land being tilled by others. They will never forgive, never forget, and never forgive for us to, for having taken their land to establish our state. So I said, so, you know, this was not new. Diane had said that 2 years before, at the grave of a friend of his who had been killed by an infiltrator from the Gaza Strip, which was under Egyptian control at that time. So I said, so what is the answer to that? Well, shall we live by, I didn't say it in such poetic way, but I asked, shall we live by the sword from here to eternity? He said, yes. And then he added in the speech he made for his friend, and don't be afraid, my brother Jacob. I mean, it was a famous speech. And he repeated more or less the same argument in 66. Then came the 66-day war, and all that became much heavier, and so on. I mean, we can speak of that or not.
Yeah, you also you talk about how you became a critic of the occupation around 1971 and received a great deal of criticism for your position, particularly because you were splitting your time then between Hebrew University and Geneva. And yet, well, on one hand, you write you're very critical of the right-wing Israeli politicians who are pushing this. You also remain critical of the Palestinian intransigence and resistance to compromise. So what's possible now? You end the book by talking, you got to talk about it. You end the book by talking about what might be done for an Israeli solution. Mainly you endorse a two-state solution. Do you still think that it's possible? Is it possible to reach peace? What would have to change in order to do that? Now, I understand if you can really answer that, they give you the Nobel Prize tonight.
The Peace Prize.
Any prize you want.
Anything. Well, that's why I won't be able to answer the question, because I don't think I really am worth the Nobel Prize. But this question is constantly asked. The more we wait and the more new settlements are built in the occupied territories, the less there is a chance of a two-state solution. Now you may say there are other solutions than the two-state, but nobody sees it as a solution. That is, the only solution then is a one-state solution, which means the two people living together in one state, but you don't imagine that the Israelis would accept for the Palestinians to be a majority eventually and dictating the policies of the binational state. This is unthinkable, knowing the difference of strengths, I would say, between the two communities. So what would be the solution? A kind of apartheid state. And I'm sorry to say that, but nobody who thinks of that sees any other. One state means either a Jewish non-democratic state and add to it a kind of apartheid situation. And the Jewish state was not established to reach that ultimate stage. I mean, this is a mockery of what Zionism was about at the beginning. idealism, a democratic state where everybody would find its place, and then with the occupied territories, giving them back for peace. Now the question you ask, is it still possible today? I mean, it's a hypothetical question, and my answer is, of course, hypothetical, totally hypothetical. It may still be the last moment. And you will say, so what happens to the settlements which are on Arab-occupied land? I would say, well, they are in blocks, you know. They are not the settlements which are out of those blocks of settlements are actually very often illegal. And we had last week an order from the Israeli Supreme Court to dismantle one of those settlements. It's very little and very late, but still. The blocks could be indeed integrated into the future Israel, and land, equivalent land, given to the Palestinian state. So that was the idea years ago of swapping land. Whether that will be possible is thinkable only if Israel stops building the settlements. I mean, you cannot continue build settlements and then say, well, let's see what happens. So if that stops, and strangely enough, and we'll come to American politics, I guess, at the end, strangely enough, even the Trump administration, which I... I'm sorry. I know. Mitch McConnell is not around, so even that administration said to Netanyahu, go slow, calm down. So that means a lot. I don't know. I, of course, cannot answer your question.
Well, you led into the next one, which is right now. And we'll go on for another 8 minutes or so, then take questions from the audience. But if we turn to the United States and the world situation today, we know that from the post-war on, never again has been the cry of many Jews. And yet, when we look at the contemporary world situation, we look at the United States, we look at Europe, we look at Russia, we look at the Middle East, it looks like the cry might be maybe again. And you end the book by suggesting there's only one lesson to be learned from the Shoah. And to quote you, that is the imperative to stand against injustice, against wanton persecution, and against the refusal to recognize the humanity and the rights of others. And in a recent interview you did with The Guardian, you discussed Donald Trump, and the quote you gave the reporter is, "This is not Weimar, but it's a catastrophe. And the more you see what Trump's inner circle is preparing, the more you get to wondering what can happen." And people like Stephen Bannon have employed the old time-worn anti-Semitic tropes that you suggest appear to be, quote, very close to the Nazis or to the neo-Nazis. And in fact, at dinner we were discussing, if you go on to today's Huffington Post, there's an article about Stephen Bannon as a big believer in the apocalypse, and that part of his political inclination is we are headed towards the fourth great moment or apocalypse. The first was the American Revolution. Second was the Civil War. The third was World War II. And the fourth one is going to change everything in the world. Well, drawing on your long history and memory of similar events in the past, how do you deal with these dual crises of what we see as the rise of fascism, and certainly in the White House, and perhaps in the Senate, and a memory of events of the past? How do we deal with this today? And, you know, in your book, you offer one humorous toss aside, which is when, you know, how do we deal with these crises? A double dose of humor when possible, otherwise a double dose of Zoloft. but on a more...
I speak also whiskey.
But on a more serious note, I think we should end our conversation on, as I mentioned to you, the Vladimir Lenin question. What is to be done? What can we do now? What can we do before it's too late, before we have to memorialize anything, while there's time still for democracy here, democracy in Israel?
Well, for Israel, I tried to say why there is no clear answer, but let's hope for the best. For the United States, I'm not... I'm at a loss like everybody else. The only thing that comes to my mind is protest with an exclamation sign after the word. That is, in French, there was a book which I didn't like very much, but which was called Mobilisez-vous, mobilize. Well, in a way, here now it's the time to mobilize, to protest, and after all, the states have a tradition of strong protests, and remember the Vietnam War, and remember Nixon. Finally, it's as much the huge protests against the war that put an end first to Johnson's presidency, then to Nixon's, and in a way, as much as the tapes, maybe. And there is a rich tradition in this country of protest. And I think that now is the time to start again. I'm not like in Berkeley, where it turned into violence, and that was a pity. But as the Women's March here in L.A. or in Washington or in New York, I mean, I understand there will be a protest in front of... the Republican chairman...
Mitch McConnell's house
tonight or something. So, I mean, not violent protest, but mass protest, massive. And that may ultimately change the... maybe get even Bannon out. But that's only hope.
Well, no, I think that's a strong likelihood. And I will tell you, one of the things that encourages me, because my two kids and my students all say to me, you know, you're a historian. What can you tell us anything that might make us feel good, that would be optimistic? And I'm always the glass is half full. So, yes. And my sense is we are seeing, finally, a revival of democracy from the people in America. It may not be coming out of Washington, but people are marching, people are protesting, they're going to airports, and they're not just going once. They're going over and over again. And I can tell you, 10 years ago, I teach a undergraduate course every year, general education. So it's nice, 150 students. 10 years ago, when we talk about politics, the vast majority had no interest in politics. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, they're both the same. They don't speak to us. We have no voice. We are out of it. No one wanted to go into politics. And now what I see is a totally engaged student body talking about these issues, wanting to change their world, and I think willing to go into politics. So to my mind, there is actually an optimistic ending, or at least there's an optimistic transition that's happening at this moment.
An optimistic ending to our conversation, which doesn't mean that it's...
Well, at this point, we've got... we're going to take questions from the audience. As interlocutor, I would ask just one caution. We'd like to get... We're going to do questions until about 8:30, and then Saul will sign books. We'd like to get as many questions as possible, so please try to be brief and make it a question, not an essay, because if you start an essay, I'm going to be Professor Ross and stop you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedlander. It was so wonderful for you to share with us and your insights. My question goes back to your days in France. You said you were brought up non-practicing Jew. I think you even said without religion. Now you were raised in a Catholic environment. You were educated in France. How come you, at age 16 or so, decided to reaffiliate, let's say, with Judaism or Jewish causes, Jewish organizations, as opposed to just staying in France and being a handsome Frenchman?
You know, sometimes I regret it, because had I stayed a Catholic, I may have become the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris, you know, Lustiger, whom I knew quite well and liked a lot. It was a Jesuit whom I went to visit in a town next to the one I was sent to him to reinforce my faith, because they knew I would be soon leaving. We speak of 45, who said to me, "Didn't your parents perish in Auschwitz?" I said, "What is Auschwitz?" I didn't have not the least idea. I knew that they wouldn't come back, that they had perished. But I had never heard of Auschwitz, of course. And so he, a Jesuit priest, told me what he could know about Auschwitz, deportations, and so on. And when I came back to the place where I had been all the time, I asked my name to be restored. That is, I had been during the war Paul-Henri-Marie Ferland, which is a very French Christian name. And I asked to be called again Paul, which was my Friedlander. So that was the beginning. Then I was brought to into a Jewish family. I had my uncles appointed a Jewish family. My uncles were in Palestine and in Sweden, appointed a Jewish family to take care of me, a kind of foster family. And but things didn't go easily at the beginning. That is, I was very submissive. That is, I didn't create any difficulties. But just one little incident. I was invited for the Seder, which is, for those who wouldn't know, the festive dinner on the eve of Passover, to my guardian's family. And he invited many people, because here was somebody coming back into the fold, that is I. And so the soup is served, and the prayers are said, the soup is served, and so on. Everything goes fine, and then we come to the meat. And I say, I'm sorry, I don't eat meat. He says, "Are you ill?" I said, "No, but it is, how do you say, Holy Friday, or the Friday." And a Catholic is not supposed to eat meat on that day. So had a bomb fallen on the house, the effect would not have been more disastrous. In the meantime, I got over that.
Professor Friedlander, good to see you again. I studied with you many years ago at UCLA, just one quarter. Do you see a change in the appreciation of knowledge and memory, truth and knowledge, between today, maybe a generation or two ago, and how things were seen in the 1930s and 1940s in Germany? A process of appreciation for truth and knowledge, or perhaps a process of self-delusion?
Yes. That is what you are asking, if I see an evolution in the German attitude to their past, or right, to their memory, in a way. Is that correct? Did I understand it? Yes, I see an evolution, but really in all to the, I must say that the beginnings in Germany after the war were very difficult. I mean, I was not very much active at that time, but I know from the history of the West German public opinion, and then, of course, today's Germany, that the beginnings were denial. I mean, there were 2 years of recognition during the Nuremberg trials and so on. And then in the 50s, nothing. It was really a way. And if anybody would mention Auschwitz, you're probably the person you were talking to would say, and what about the bombing of Dresden or of all German cities? I mean, the criminals were on both sides. So you couldn't really have a discussion at that time. And then the student movement in the late 60s, early 70s changed a lot. The Auschwitz trial, the Eichmann trial in Jerusalem, the two Auschwitz trials did jolt public opinion. And from then on, the event which turned opinion around and created a demand for information on the Shoah is something nobody here would figure out, except if I said that in my course at UCLA. And that is, it was not something serious, some serious book or history or whatever. It was the film Holocaust, the NBC, really Hollywood kitsch film Holocaust. Well, it is. It's a film which today, a movie you couldn't watch today. I mean, the Hollywood actors in the worst situations. And that, you wouldn't believe, here as well. I mean, here as well, a majority of the population would learn something about the fate of the Jews from the Hollywood NBC film done on the as a mirror image of Roots, which some of you may remember, ABC Roots, that is one victim group, now comes the next. I mean, the idea was to make a commercial, and it was a commercial success of millions of people all over the world, including the United States, where nobody really spoke very much about the Shoah, except those who had gone through it and were speaking among themselves. In Germany, within after the first screening, there were three or four, I don't remember now, the phones of the television station which was screening it couldn't handle the number of demands and questions. How comes we didn't know about this? Which in itself is, of course, a joke, because, of course, the Germans knew. We really went into details. The historians of that period, think that about 30 to 40 million Germans were aware of the fact that the Jews and others, but the Jews in particular, were being exterminated in the East. They didn't know the details, but they knew that. So after the war, silence, after Nuremberg. And then slowly ups and downs until you reach this turning point of a ridiculous, actually, event, which is a film of little value. But it was such a shock, it seems, that people started demanding from the academic community, so details. You had discussions on TV, you had whatever. You had the first international conference on the Shoah in Germany, historical conference, in 1984, which was very shortly after the screening of the film. It was the first time that in Germany you had an international historical conference on the Shoah, 1945-84. There is one great historian of the Shoah, Raoul Hilberg. Some of you may know his name. His book came out in English, summary of it for its time and for a long time of what we know about the perpetrators of the Shoah. The book came out in 1961, The Destruction of the European Jews. It was translated into German in 1983. So it's exactly the same dates, you see. So that was the turning point. But today that is, since then and more, if you go and lecture on these topics, you would have a huge audience, extremely attentive, extremely serious in its reactions. So I would say the Germans are those who did most of the work of memory, I would say, regarding Israel was not a good example in that sense for a simple reason, that Ben-Gurion, when the state was created, didn't want to hear about the Jews as victims. He wanted the fighter, the new Jew, and the diaspora Jews, he called them once, Avak Adam, in Hebrew, Avak, Eli. Human dust. That's my son. my translator. So human dust, which was not exactly exemplary. And so there was a kind of suppression of the knowledge or of the Shoah. Also, everybody knew people who had perished or had family who had perished. And the knowledge was subterranean, if you wish, and there were 300,000 survivors living in Israel. And you had two huge events, the Kastner trial and the German reparation. So Israel was not cut from it, but there was an ideology of rejecting it, which changed after the Six-Day War and so on. Germany is today, I would say, a positive example, not Austria, but Germany, not Hungary, but Germany. I mean, it's a long story. Maybe not France, I don't know.
I just want to add one anecdote to that. Again, when I watched I can remember watching the Holocaust, it was 1978, and I thought, this is a pallid gloss on something so enormous. But I got it wrong. Because in my household, that Seder, that year, my parents, like many survivors, both of them survivors, as Louise mentioned, they only socialized with survivors. Mm-hmm. So when we were at a dinner table, I can remember there were about 16 people, and my sister and I were the ones with the accents, because they all sounded the same. And they started discussing it. No one ever talked about their experience in the camps. None of them. My mother just told me she had nightmares every night, and my father never talked about anything. And their friends never talked about anything. And that night, they started talking about it, mm-hmm. and I said, why are you talking about it? And I remember crystal clear, they said, if it's okay to talk about the Holocaust on American television, we have permission to talk about it with our family, our friends, and with everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would add something which I noticed in Europe and here when I worked with Goldman and so on, that people didn't want to look like victims. I mean, they were victims. They came out of the camps. They survived. But they wouldn't want the surrounding society in which they were taken in, U.S., to consider them as victims, as survivors. They were new Americans wanting to build a new life in a new country. And it's only when they got much older, of course, the Holocaust played a role, but also the generational change played a role. The Holocaust survivors came of really of age. They were in their 50s, 60s, and so on. Then they were established. Then they could speak. They were not afraid anymore that one would stop their progress in the new society.
Yeah, it's not just the fear. It's within my family and their friends, it was they didn't want to look back. And I remember asking my mother once, you have nightmares every night. Every night, every night. Why don't you go to a therapist? Hmm. And her response is, oh, the therapist is going to tell me the Holocaust didn't happen. The therapist is going to tell me I wasn't in Auschwitz. I wasn't in Bergen-Belsen. I wasn't in Salzwedel. What is a therapist going to do for me? Forget about it. I just want to move on with my life.
I just want to thank you both. This is a really important discussion to have now, and I want to thank you all for being here. And I hope
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.